journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, August 30th, 2007. Sitting in for Sonali, I'm your host, Aimori Soundararajan.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Katrina and women, curfew lifted in Bangladesh, and LGBT glass youth speak out about their live arts music video workshop.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the fellow meadows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. When Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast, the devastation left in its wake ignited discussions on race and even class in the United States. However, even as women were disproportionately affected by the storm, few experts connected gender to the debate. The New Orleans pre-Katrina population was more than half women, and today when you look at the statistics around housing, healthcare, even incarceration, women, especially black women, are much more vulnerable. Many major Katrina-related issues such as housing, redevelopment, and environmental degradation have taken a particular toll on low-income women and women of color. When speaking of the right to return and calling on the federal government to restore public housing, it is important to note that women-headed houses accounted for 88% of public housing units lost in New Orleans before the storm hit. The majority of jobs lost due to Hurricane Katrina were overwhelmingly held by women. And after the storm, women's median income in New Orleans is still significantly lower than that of their male counterparts. In the Gulf Coast Reconstruction Watch new report, 1 year after Katrina, Shayna Griffin, a NOLA women's organizer and national board member of InSight, stated that it was important to not only offer services to the invisible women in the Gulf, but to also challenge the conditions that limit our access and our opportunities, such as poverty, racism, gender-based violence, imperialism, and war. Despite the hardships faced, women activists in the Gulf Coast region have been engaged over the past 2 years in the task of reviving their respective communities. Multi-pronged strategic grants from the Ms. Foundation has been helpful in supporting numerous community-based Gulf Coast organizations predominantly led by low-income women and women of color. Through supported efforts in the hurricane-affected regions, have been able to recover both owned incomes as well as win women important seats on planning and commissions. Joining us to talk about where the women of NOLA are at 2 years after Katrina is Almita Franken, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance, and Sarah K. Gould, president of the Ms. Foundation for Women. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Almita, can you share with our listeners where you are from in New Orleans and what the women you live with are grappling with in your community?
Actually, I'm from a rural community outside of New Orleans, about 90 miles. It's St. Mary Parish, and it's actually the towns of Franklin, the municipalities of Franklin, Morgan City, Patterson, are within that jurisdiction. A lot of the women that came from New Orleans are now in St. Mary Parish. They have chose to stay here. A lot of them want to go back home, but there are no provisions for getting them and the children back into their home areas.
And when you're talking about, I think one of the things in looking at what Shayna was talking about is that you can't really look at the way services are being offered to support women without first addressing the fact that the women were invisible. How did you feel that women in the Gulf were made invisible throughout the whole Katrina process, like both like immediately after the hurricane was hit and in the corresponding months?
Well, one of the things that I found most disturbing about the plight of women and children was that there were no specific projects available to them other than for nonprofits. As they started to work through FEMA and Road Home and Louisiana Housing Authority and all of the different projects that were set up, they were mostly directed toward two-family households. Mm. And the plight of single parents, mostly headed by single African-American women, were never a target group.
That's right. I also thought what was, I think mostly immediately after Katrina, in when people were trying to find refuge, I think that there was a lot of incidences about violence that happened towards women, whether it was by the National Guard or the police or even within the evacuees within the Superdome. How do you feel like some of that violence was tracked, and has there been any accountability afterwards? And what are the women asking for in terms of accountability and support for healing afterwards?
I tell you, you know, we heard a lot of that, and a lot of the ladies that we did the case management with, they discussed that some of them were traumatized by that. But because they had a more immediate need, that was survival, having housing for their children, making sure the children got in adequate schooling and that they got jobs or had some source of income coming in, that was not our first priority with the women. Our first priority was making sure that they had shelter, that they had a place to stay, and that the children were able to get in school. However, the second part of that was that we tried to provide some counseling for some of the ladies or develop support groups where they could talk about some of the experiences that they had. Like one lady told me she had not been able to sleep at night because she remembered seeing a baby drown during the time she was trying to get out of the hurricane path.
I want to remind our listeners that is Amita Franken, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance. I want to turn to you, Sarah. You are president of the Miss Foundation, and I want to talk about how did the Miss Foundation get involved in supporting the women in the Gulf, and what were some of the challenges you faced in being able to give the people that needed the resources right at the point of need?
Well, the Miss Foundation responded immediately the weekend that the levees broke and New Orleans and the Gulf Coast was in such, unconscionable situation, because it's very related to our mission. It's core to our mission to be working with and responding to those most in need, and particularly women of color and low-income women. And we work at the intersection of race, class, and gender. So we began to raise money immediately, and we reached out to our grantees in the region, those we already had, and got some emergency funding down to them, including organizations working on with women on HIV and AIDS, working on sexual assault, domestic violence, the shelters, of course, in New Orleans and in other places across the coast, were as devastated as and were out of business. So there was much that needed to be responded to immediately. We felt that our longer-term niche was in recovery and rebuilding, and we had a vision that when a area and a region has been so decimated, that perhaps it opens up space for there to be new kinds of conversations and new voices that have not been at tables before able to come forward. And that has been pushing our work for the last 2 years. We've now granted about $2 million on the Gulf Coast to a variety of organizations that are working on issues from daycare to housing to representation and civic participation in general. And I wanted to make one comment on the invisibility of women. Of course, it goes back to before the hurricanes. Women are invisible, and African-American women, low-income women, other women of color, even more invisible than white women in our society because of this intersection of sexism and racism and all of the other barriers that are put in the way in our democracy towards real equal participation, towards working towards a more equal representation and participation for everyone.
And I want to just repeat the fact that I think that it's really invisible to the media and invisible in terms of the policymakers, but not invisible in terms of the New Orleans and really in our larger society. And I wanted to self-correct on that, because in just going back to the statistics, it was amazing that in so much of the coverage that happened in terms of the housing that was lost, that there was very few mainstream media outlets that noted that 80% of the public housing units that were lost were, like, led by women. That's
absolutely.
It's
correct.
It to me, I think that's just as unconscionable. And I want to go back to you, Almitra. How have you seen women being able to come to the table differently in the reconstruction process? And has stuff changed? And what do you think are some of the challenges that women are facing?
Well, one of the things I saw that I'd not seen before, women were more vocal. Before, you know, even with the Head Start program and with our housing movement, and not only in the in my work area, which is, again, mostly rural, but throughout the state, you know, women would not come to the table, per se, to discuss those issues about housing and the need for housing and how we needed to ramp up and really have a section of houses that was dedicated to ladies, to single households, to mothers with children. But women have really been coming to the table. I think Katrina really forced the issue with women, and it made them understand that I am going to have to speak up for myself and for my children.
We've been speaking with, and that was Almitra Franklin, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance. And also on the line is Sarah K. Gould, president of the Ms. Foundation for Women. Almitra, what do you think, if for people that want to support women in the Gulf, and who for people that don't really know what it's like in the Gulf, what do you think, how can people best support the work that you're doing? And what are, once again, I think just if you can give us some stories about, like, what women are dealing with and their challenges, I think that'll help really paint the picture for our audience.
A lot of the ladies that we work with who came out of New Orleans and the surrounding area are still having a really rough time locating permanent housing. We still have a lot of these families who are in the FEMA trailers. There are currently some issues with the trailers about a formaldehyde and the safeness of those trailers. We're trying to move those families back to New Orleans who wish to go there, but there's no housing there, let me say that.
I mean, it's incredible that 2 years,
I mean,
it's not, 2 years you still have people
exactly
living
right.
in temporary housing.
Exactly right. And the ladies who have chose to relocate to rural communities or communities like mine, you know, there's no housing available because we had an influx of additional residents in our area that caused the already strained housing market to just burst open. Mm-hmm. Therefore, what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop housing that can assist these families. Public housing authorities have units that have been boarded up, have been closed up. What they have done and put on their agenda is to rehabilitate those units and open them up so that these families would have the opportunities to have at least some sort of normalcy in terms of housing. Living in a FEMA trailer is not a normal scenario for a family.
That's right. And you had mentioned about the shift of people being displaced into the rural parishes outside of the city. What has that been like culturally? Like, is that a cultural shift? Is it an economic shift?
I always tell my clients, it's like, for those who are not used to being in this rural setting, it's like a culture shock. Because in the inner cities, they were able to catch the bus system, and they were able to walk to many of the services that they needed. But because we're in a rural area, everything is so spread out, and the amount of transportation that's available is very limited. Therefore, you know, we had to address that issue. How are we going to get our clients from point A to point B? And we even had to do some innovative stuff. Like, for an example, we have a program called Cause for a Cause, where those working mothers who decide they want to go through a literacy, financial literacy project, at the end of 6 months, they can get a car. It's a used car, but it's a relatively good car. It's a donated car to help them to get around and be able to go to things with the children, extracurricular things with the children, to even seek out spirituality. If they want to go to church on Sunday, they will have a form of transportation. Because, again, in the rural community, what you see in the city is so different.
Sarah, I wanted to go with you because I wanted to really see how are you trying to link the different strategies you're funding in the Gulf in terms of going from policy strength and structural change to the kind of internal transformative work, and how have you been successful, or what are some of the challenges around that?
Well,
both of you. Well, why don't we go with Sarah, then I'll meet you. Do you want to chime in after that?
I sure will.
Great.
All right, that's great. There are many challenges around it because, of course, women like Almitra are working day in and day out on the most pressing needs, and also at the same time trying to think of how to solve problems for the future. We have combined in our work both the grant making to get money out to leaders and to organizations with some gathering and bringing people together for certain kinds of activities. For instance, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we brought together some of our grantees to learn about making radio documentaries so that they could get these stories out that that you speak of that are so powerful, and all the stories that if we had the time, even more time to listen to Almitra, she could tell about herself and the women that she's been working with. So we've combined our grant making with other kinds of activities, and I'm in New Orleans right now, and 2 nights ago went to a gathering organized by one of our grantees, the National Coalition for Black Civic Participation, led by Melanie Campbell, and we have supported them to be gathering women throughout the region in the 3 states of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. About 60 or 75 of those women were brought to New Orleans for these couple of days of commemoration. And 2 nights ago, they had a celebratory dinner honoring all of these women for the role that each one of them has played, which was articulated during the dinner. And, you know, it's overwhelming. But it is a process of healing, of emotional healing and of spiritual healing, and moving forward on a day-by-day basis to try to confront all of the issues and problems that exist, to deal with the anger that you have, and to keep a sense of hope at the same time.
And I just want to jump in and say that for us being a Miss Foundation grantee, the dollars that they provided us was really a godsend. I tell you, you know, we get some state and some federal funding for some specific programs, but nobody had ever laid anything out there to direct those dollars toward assisting women in those ways that are non-traditional, like making sure that the families had transportation, that they had somebody to come in and do counseling with them, and even to get them to the table. For an example, we took some of the ladies with us to Baton Rouge to a committee that was being held in Baton Rouge with the legislators to talk about the failure of the rebuilding of New Orleans. And some of those ladies had never been to the Capitol before. They did not know what a committee session would look like, but they got the opportunity to see firsthand the workings and even how policies are made and how those policies affect you and your family. It's that kind of empowerment the Miss Foundation is allowing our agency to do with the grants that they make to us. And not only the grants, but they provide us with marketing and advertisement that put our agencies out there so other funders can know that we're here, we're doing this work, but we need dollars to support our efforts.
And I think it's, you know, it's unfortunate, but I definitely think it's one of the realities of organizing in the United States, that foundations are picking up a lot of the gap where actually the government and mm-hmm. state services and other agencies really should be showing leadership. And I think that part of whatever organizing strategy we have, while it can be foundation-based, we still need to be self-determined and really hold our government accountable, because our taxes are paying for something, and it's clearly not for us.
And that's why directing attention to policies and policy issues are so important to us. And again, you know, some of to our legislators and the people who are making these major decisions, a lot of these women are just faceless and nameless. Mm. but we can bring their story to the table. We can bring their voices to the table through organizations like ours and other grantees that are out there working in the trenches trying to make a difference with our clients.
Well, Amita, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but before we do, I wanted to be able to leave our listeners with a forward look at some of the policies that you are working on to support women's rights in the region. Is there one or two you could reference for our listeners before we close?
Sure. What the big thing with us right now, you know, is housing. We're concerned about women having adequate housing, and affordability means everything to the people we serve. We're working with the Louisiana Housing Alliance and the Louisiana Housing Authority, which is through the LHFA, to develop a housing trust fund for Louisiana. And a part of that trust fund would be directed to our targeting women who are heads of households, who have children in the house, who want to become homeowners.
All right. And can people visit you on the web? Is there a website where people can visit the work that you're doing?
My website is under construction right now. It was so old and outdated that we had to take it down to put some of the good things that we had available. So it's under construction right now, but I expect that in the next about 3 weeks it's going to be up. But just let me get that website out there. It's stmaryca.org.
St. Mary's.
And let me put out the Ms. website where you can hear these radio documentaries and read more stories of the grantee leaders like Almitra that we're funding. And that is ms.foundationspelledout.org.
And it's a wonderful reference for us and for our clients, because when they can't get to our website, we tell them go to Ms. Foundation and you can see some of the work that we're doing there.
Okay. Well, thank you both for joining us. We send you all of our wishes for continued healing and also government accountability. So if there's any question that women's rights aren't human rights, this is really where the rubber meets the road. So thank you both for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Amita Franklin, CEO of St. Mary's Community Action Agency and the Louisiana Housing Alliance, and Sarah Gould, president of the Ms. Foundation. Later in our show, Bangladesh lifts the military-imposed curfew, and LGBT Glass youth speak out about their live arts music video workshop and radio roots in this day in radical history. But first, what happens when your community does not receive assistance to rebuild homes and move residents back after a huge national disaster? What happens when the only union work available is for able-bodied men? Well, if you are like the women of the Moore Community House in Gulfport, Mississippi, you train your community in construction work and begin doing it yourself. LaWanda White of the Moore Community House has this report from Gulfport, Mississippi.
It's almost 2 years since Hurricane Katrina, and all around the Gulf Coast, houses are still standing empty.
I feel like after 2 years, I would say at least 60% should be built back, but you look around, there's so much obstacles we have to face, and it's like, oh man, when are we ever going to reach that bridge?
Like me, Monica Connolly lives in Gulfport, Mississippi.
And I know people get tired of us talking about Hurricane Katrina, but we really didn't get enough help in a good time frame. We wouldn't be talking about it after 2 years if everything would have came out the way it's supposed to, and then we really wouldn't have nothing to complain about.
Monica isn't complaining. She's not waiting for help. She's taking reconstruction into her own hands, thanks to a new construction training program.
Well, I decided to take this because I want to be able to do my own repairs at my house and cut the labor costs down and to have a good career, long-term career, because if you look around, Mississippi is going to have a long ways to build back.
Brody Walker, Monica's teacher, says the construction industry is booming since the storm.
Well, there's definitely a lot more work down here, and there's a lot more work that we still have to do, and it's going to take a collective effort from the whole community, male, female, black, white, Hispanic. It's going to take a collective effort from everybody to get it done, you know. So we got work to do here, and there's a lot more to do for many years to come. Yeah.
Our collective effort is a little short on women. Monica is one of just two women in the training course. And despite the desperate need for skilled labor, women aren't necessarily welcome on job sites. Brody Walker.
We still live in an age where we have, you know, male chauvinists, and they think that the woman's place is basically at home and not on the construction field. We still have that type of mentality.
That mentality might come from years of male domination in the construction industry. Eddie Sherman has worked in the field for a decade, and the only woman he worked with wasn't getting her hands dirty.
I had a safety manager that was a woman, but I've never sat next to a woman with a tool belt on and worked with them before I came down here.
With so much left to rebuild, the Gulf Coast is opening up new opportunities for women in construction. Regina Phillips is the single parent coordinator for Hands On America. She says, with most jobs, women can't make ends meet.
It's not really a whole lot of jobs that are good paying jobs for women.
The construction industry does offer a living wage, and more women, like this client of Regina Phillips, are finding jobs in the building trades.
She started out as a laborer making $10 an hour. And now she's doing something else where she's making, I think, $15, $16 an hour. And she said you can even go up from there.
These women are changing more than the industry. Remember Monica in the building training program? She says that now the men in her life see her a little different.
My kids would look up to me like, ooh, mama built this or mama did this. And it's like, yeah, nine, I can show my brothers I did it. So I don't need you. I have to call you. I can do it myself.
Kaya Blaylock is also in the Home Builders Institute program with Monica. She wishes more women would take on construction.
It's very empowering to let a male counterpart know that, you know, I am just as good as you. You know, I could do this too.
Okay, we know that there are physical differences between men and women. But Brody Walker says women shouldn't let that hold them back.
You don't really necessarily have to be the one that's maybe driving the sledgehammer, but you could be the one that with the air nailer in your hand. You know, you can do that as long as you do it good and do it right.
As a matter of fact, there are some unique strengths that women bring to the job. Quincy Davis is a site supervisor for Hands On, a volunteer organization rebuilding homes on the Gulf Coast. We visited her on a job site where she was working with her all-female crew.
One of my guy volunteers was caulking a doorway, and I was sort of pointing out how, you know, it's hard to get the caulk all smooth in the corners, so you have to sort of use your pinky. And he looked at me, he's like, yeah, except your pinky's a little bit smaller than mine is, you know. Sometimes it is actually easier if you have smaller hands to be able to do things. And I think it's important to help women understand that they're not at a disadvantage.
Too many women don't understand that yet. In Gulfport, Mississippi, I'm LaWanda White with Carissa.
Welcome back to Uprising. After we hear This Day in Radical History, we'll turn to Bangladesh, so stay tuned.
You're listening to Uprising on KPFK, and tune in as we discuss Iraqi refugees, a people with a broken country and a few options for life. The discussion will include a representative of Refugees International, the International Medical Corps, a 23-year-old Iraqi refugee in Amman, Jordan, and someone who was internally displaced in Baghdad with the rest of their family. That and more this afternoon at 3 on Radio Intifada. Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman is coming up at 9. Stay tuned.
Some of Us Are Brave is a black women's radio program heard every Thursday at 2 p.m. right here on KPFK. Check us out. 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, August 30th in 1967, Thurgood Marshall was confirmed as a Supreme Court Justice, becoming the first African American to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. Prior to this appointment, Marshall was an exceptional lawyer working closely with the NAACP and successfully arguing many civil rights cases, including the famous Supreme Court case Brown versus the Board of Education. Marshall was also known for his support of abortion rights and strong opposition to the death penalty. But despite his liberal views, Thurgood Marshall was reportedly friendly with the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, even when Hoover actively worked to discredit many of the more radical civil rights activists. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Welcome back to Uprising. Earlier this week, the military-backed government of Bangladesh lifted an overnight curfew that had been imposed on six main cities. The curfew was the government's response to demonstrations that began on August 20th at Dhaka University by students demanding the removal of army posts on college campuses. The students also protested the failure of the army-backed government, which declared a state of emergency on January 12th to clean up Bangladesh's corrupt politics before holding elections by 2008. Protests spread to other colleges across the country and then onto city streets. Many vendors and slum dwellers also joined the heated street protests, setting vehicles on fire and damaging buildings and public property. One person was killed and hundreds were wounded, prompting the government to impose the curfew. Since its implementation, more than 144 people have been arrested for violating the nighttime curfew since last Wednesday. In late 2006, a so-called caretaker government was installed according to the Bangladeshi constitution to ensure fair voting and transfer of power. However, the temporary arrangement, slated to last 3 months, was prolonged as the 2006 election was postponed indefinitely. This past January, the nonpartisan head of the caretaker government stepped down, many believe due to pressure from the military. Emergency law was declared with an interim authority currently headed by Bangladesh's former central bank chief, Fakhruddin Ahmed. Joining us to discuss the student movement in Bangladesh is Sumaya Islam from the Civil Rights Unit of South Asian Network, a human rights organization based in Los Angeles. Welcome, Sumaya.
Thank you.
So, Sumaya, can you help put what this decision was into context for our listeners? Like, what is the impact of the lifting of the curfew, and what does this mean for the student movement?
The student movement in Bangladesh and in South Asia has been deep-rooted because there has been, it's a very organized structure, and now that the Election Commission has opened the for electoral reform talks for September 12th, this hasn't curbed the student movement, but it will enhance it because the students will be watchful of what is happening. What is important to consider is that the incidents that happened on August 20th is not a single incident. It is it has been a culture of the police to sort of dictate its terms on the students, and it has happened in 1983. It has happened in 1990. That it has happened throughout the history that police and army has gone into Dhaka University, has gone into the universities and have raided the dormitories and halls where the students live and basically caused them to be deserted because most of them come from out of the city to live in the dorms. And when the halls are closed and they're sort of forced to be either deserted in railway stations. So there's a lot of anger already pent up amongst the students against the police authorities and the army camps.
And Sumaya, I think one of the things that was very interesting about researching this segment is that there was a lot of information about the damage, quote-unquote, done by movements, by people in the street, but there was very few about what the demands were. And I was wondering if you can talk about both what the students were asking for and the context for their requests, but also what, you know, this student movement really set a fire throughout Bangladesh. And so to really talk about what people are frustrated about, because there's very little clear information about it.
Right. There was a five-point demand after the army camp beat up the students, and they included withdrawal of the army and police camps from educational institutions across the country within the next 24 hours at that period of time, and punishment of the culprits of that who were causing the incidents, a public apology from the Chief of Armed Forces, treatment and compensation for the wounded in the violence, and guarantee of a democratic environment throughout the country, which sound very reasonable, but a lot of people sort of took that, why did they include the democratic environment and about the elections? But the students are very much part of the political system that exists in Bangladesh. Every political party has a student section, and therefore the demands are very much in lieu of that. But also there has been a lot of destruction on the streets, and that has been the nature of a lot of the South Asians, especially in Bangladesh also, a lot of the protests and strikes. People go out on the streets and they strike and protest, and they use whatever means they have necessary to sort of retaliate against police brutality. Therefore, we see a lot of reports, because a lot of reports have been engineered and sort of indoctrinated by the government, that they want, how they want the protest to be portrayed.
And Sum, I want to remind our listeners, we are speaking with Sumaya Islam from the Civil Rights Unit of the South Asian Network, an immigrant rights and human rights organization based in Los Angeles, and she is helping us put some of the recent events in Bangladesh in context. So Sumaya, I wanted to ask you, there's also been a lot of discussion about the corruption of the government in Bangladesh, which is really what brought to power the current military-backed structure that's in power right now. But I wanted to ask you, like, where is the position and what is happening towards alleviating corruption, and is the movement one of the only ways and pressures that's going to actually bring some relief to the citizens of Bangladesh?
There has been, and a lot of cases have been filed against former politicians. A lot of people have gone absconding. And the present government has made some harsh decisions to ensure a more corruption-free political system.
Well, and can I interrupt you a little quick, just in terms for our listeners? Like, you know, I think most people assume that their government is corrupt, but what in particular about Bangladesh's political system was so corrupt that it brought, you know, that it was brought to this position?
What in particular?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was very top-heavy in terms of the corruption, and it was done periodically by both parties, and including the military, and whoever came into power, it has been sort of ingrained into the system. There was a clear distinction between people's income level and the assets that they had, and such investigations which were not as transparent, quote-unquote, as stated by the government, present government. Their investigations revealed that the discrepancy in terms of the assets owned and the income levels. And mm-hmm. There's not a major disclosure of assets by these political party people.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to emphasize that this caretaker government's main task is to strengthen democracy through a fair and free election, and for that, the restrictions on politics, and as per se indoor politics, need to be sort of taken off, because that itself is non-democratic. So even if the electoral reforms have been, they have opened up the dialogues, but still there is a ban on indoor politics.
Mm-hmm. And what are next steps for the student movements and the national movements towards open and free elections, and, you know, to some of the political goals that were raised in this time?
I don't think I would be in that sort of capacity to mention the next steps, but what has happened is, since the curfew has been lifted, people have been charged, teachers have been picked up and detained without charges being filed against them, and they have been mentally tortured. So the student movement has been gearing up towards addressing those issues, how the anger from the government has been now shifted towards the teachers of the Dhaka University. And I think one of the main parts of the movement is to lift this policing of educational institutions. And we all know that policing in modern liberal democracies involves police living a lie. So even though they pretend to be servants of the law, what they become are masters. So this sort of brutal behavior from the police and the army needs to stop it in the educational institutions.
Well, we are going to have to leave it right there. I mean, clearly we are going to need to keep our eye on Bangladesh, because I'm sure once the international attention, the military repression against these, you know, brave student leaders and their and the teachers and the people that are in the streets will continue. So we will definitely hope to come back and talk with you soon for any updates. But thank you for joining us, Sumaya.
Thank you.
That was Sumaya Islam from the Civil Rights Unit of the South Asian Network. For more information, you can reach them at www.southasiannetwork.org. We will not be airing our peace vigils today, but you can always visit our we will air our weekly peace vigils on tomorrow's program. Up next, Queer Youth from Glass pass it on in their 8-week music video workshop.
What's the blues?
Oh, I know. Blues is nothing but a feeling.
Thank you.
The feeling can be something that you've had too long that you don't want no more. Or it can be something that you have wanted for a long time and you know you ain't gonna never get.
Have you ever been mistreated?
The blues, a passionate, soulful expression rooted out of African culture, blossoming on American soil. Born of love and love betrayed, the pleasure and pains of the flesh, revealing poetry and life stories, accentuated by tragedy and comedy, joy and magic, the realities and facts of life. Join Louise Foster and Bobby Zeno every Thursday evening at 10:30 p.m. for a real juke joint night of fun and exploration. Blues Power right here on Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7.
Welcome back to Uprising. While easier than it was in the past, growing up queer or transgendered in Los Angeles is still difficult. Queer and trans youth, according to the U.S. Department of Health statistics, are 5 times more likely to miss school because of feeling unsafe, 2 times as likely to abuse drugs, and 4 times as likely to attempt suicide. Queer and trans youth comprise nearly 30% of the estimated 5,000 completed youth suicides annually. Equally alarming are the rates of homelessness amongst LGBT trans youth. Over 26% of gay and lesbian youth are forced to leave home because of conflicts with their families over their sexual identities. Helping queer and trans youth in such conditions is the Gay and Lesbian Adolescent Social Services of Los Angeles, or GLASS. GLASS is the nation's first ever long-term residential treatment program designed specifically for self-identified gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, questioning, and intersex youth. GLASS recently collaborated with the Live Arts Project for an 8-week Pass It On music video workshop. Live Arts is a West Hollywood-based arts program started by Diane Carey and Jim Perriott, which connects youth from underserved communities with emerging filmmakers. Joining us in studio today are Kenya and Luke, 2 youth from GLASS and the Live Arts Project, as well as Live Arts founder Diane Carey. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Kenya, Luke, thank you for transcending the statistics and joining us today. How are you?
You're welcome. Very good.
Okay, so Kenya, let me start with you. Why was it important to you to pick up a camera and tell your story and be part of a workshop like this?
Well, you know, when I first got the camera, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing, but as I got adapted to the camera, I got to be active. I got to be showing them my talent. So it was really good getting the camera together.
And do you feel like you've been given that power a lot in your life before? Like, was it one of the first times? Like, was it, like, for you, like, how often do people look at you and say, hey, you're talented, you got power, run with it?
Yeah, it was like everybody was telling me that I was good at it, and it made me feel good because, you know, at least I'm doing something great. And it was really good, so.
All right. Luke, I wanted to ask you, what was your experience in terms of working in music videos? And this was this your first time?
Oh, it was my first time doing a music video and stuff. I mean, I took photography before with regular cameras, but I never, like, used, like, a video camera and actually recorded, like, people acting. So it was different, and it was very exciting. gave me something to look forward to.
And how do you feel in terms of, do you see a lot of trans representation in the media? Like, why was it important for you as a trans filmmaker to really be seen and be seen in the director's chair?
It was important because, can you ask the question?
Yeah, no worries. We all choke. It's all part of the process.
Lots to think about.
You know, I think that, you know, in terms of being a trans youth, like, how often do you see media that features trans people positively?
Not a lot. I mean, I've seen one of the 2020 shows. I don't know what the lady's name is, but I saw a transgender show about that.
Oh, with Barbara Walters?
Yeah, but that was really well, but I don't see, like, a lot of, like positive stuff about, you know, gay, lesbian, or transgender. So it was good that they came and worked with us because it made us feel better about ourselves. Like, yeah. It made, you know, it was that someone was there for us and actually, like, wanted to do something for us, even though we're different than everyone. It made you feel good that, you know, who cares what people think, you know? We're ourselves, and, like, no one's going to change that. And just to feel comfortable with a bunch of people, like, living in glass, like, it's really good for me because I feel comfortable and I can identify as who I am. So it was good that people came out to do stuff with us.
And what did it feel like to be a director for the first time?
It felt good. I mean, I've directed before, like, my own stuff because I wrote a play, but...
go on with your bad self.
No, I mean, I was like, teaching other kids, like, how to act and stuff, but, like, I wasn't, like, never, like, a director. Like, I've never taken classes or anything, but, like, for the time, like, with the camera and everything, like, play, like, actors up and saying all the words, it felt cool.
Kenya, I wanted to go back to you. You know, when you, you know, I feel like there's, you know, the statistics are one thing, but I think when you hear personal stories and your own story about what queer trans youth have to really deal with, like, when you were picking up the camera and talking about your own work in these music videos, like, what do you hope to change? Like, what did you want?
Well, I just wanted, you know, them to be themselves, you know, and be called what they want to be called. And it gave us a chance to be who we are. And this video made us, like, you know, be active and...
Yeah, no, definitely. Diane, I wanted to go to you. Tell us a little bit about the live arts workshop process and how long is it? What is it made out of? Because most people don't think of music videos as a community-based arts project. And, you know, as a program you could do in community, I think we think of Flash, we think of Bling. We don't think about people being empowered in that process. So I want you to talk a little bit about your vision for this.
Yeah, well, our company is a West Hollywood-based company comprised of Hollywood professionals. And we wanted to create a workshop where there's an old expression, give them the fishing poles, not the fish. So we're giving them the skills. We wanted to give back. And as I said, we're all Hollywood professionals and we know filmmaking. So music video is really a short film. It's a form like a poem. Is a short form of literature. Music video is one of the shortest forms of filmmaking, and which was doable in 8 weeks. So it's an eight-week workshop. We work with the youth aged 13 to 17 for about 6 hours a week and longer days on two shoot days. And they create two-minute music videos to popular music, which is the motivating factor. They get to choose from the very latest music. And in the meantime, they're learning all the various crafts of filmmaking, starting with writing to storyboarding, shooting. They can be in it if they want, and then editing. And by the end, they've been introduced to all the different forms, the careers that are potential careers for them in Hollywood.
And it's been a pretty popular project throughout all of the Glass Houses, right? Like, mm-hmm. How many youth have you been able to serve through this project?
Yeah, well, last year was our first experience at Glass, and it was fantastic. We worked with four of the six foster homes, 24 youth. And when we went back this year, the new set of – they changed the population there about once a year. I believe it kind of transitions out and new kids come in. And they had seen the videos from last year and all 42 students wanted to do it. And,
wow.
Of course, the head of the center said, no, only 24. You have to be on good behavior. And he called me in a panic 3 weeks before and said, I told them they had to be on good behavior if they wanted to do the workshop, and all 42 kids are on good behavior. So it was really great, and we didn't have much time to get prepared, but we did it.
So, and this process, during the 8 weeks, you storyboarded, created a video, mm-hmm. and now those videos are ready to be screened. So is there a place where people can come and see the work that you did?
Yeah, we're going to have a free screening tomorrow night at Plummer Park from 7:30 p.m. I don't know what time it's going to end, but
it's free.
18 minutes.
The best part is that it's free, everybody.
It's free.
Everybody.
Free. Yes.
It's free, and there's going to be how many videos that are being shown?
Six videos.
And are you guys going to also be introducing your videos as well, so people can meet you and talk to you as filmmakers?
I don't know. I mean, we're going to be there.
We're going to be there. That's
but I don't know if we're going to introduce our video.
Yeah.
According to Kenya, that's the point.
That's the point of me being there, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
You see us in our suits? I don't know if I'm going to have my suit or not.
Oh, you got to wear those suits.
Yeah, I'm going to wear
my
suit.
They wore these wonderful bright colored suits. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of what are your guys' next steps in terms of, like, film projects that you want to work on, or just where do you see yourself going? Because I think that in a lot of the news, queer youth are just a statistic. You're just a statistic, and you only get to be referenced if you're there in terms of something negative. And I really want to leave our audience with the things that you guys are doing in terms of being on the up and up. So, Luke, let me start with you, and then I'll end with you, Kenya.
So, like, what was the question?
Like, what's your next project you want to go? You're thinking about working on as a filmmaker, or what are your next dreams or your next goals?
I mean, I want to. I don't know exactly. I want to be either an architect or a firefighter, but I don't really like want to do anything in the filmmaking. It was just a good experience, but mm-hmm. I'm not like think that's not my main interest. Mm-hmm. So I don't think like when they come back next year, if I'm still here, I'll do it again. But, I mean, it was fun and it was cool and everything, but, like, I don't think that's, like, the right career for me. Mm. So,
But your goals are really to be an architect.
And or something. I'm not exactly sure right now. I'm going back and forth.
That's okay. I'm 30 and back in school, too. Sometimes you're always trying to figure out what you want to mm-hmm. do.
Yeah.
But just being able to have the choice and being able to know that you have those positive options and you have people to support you and love you in that time is, like, really, you know, what helps. And I think arts programs definitely are a place where you get nurtured and do that, you know. Kenya, what about you? What are next steps for you?
Well, for me, I learn a lot of things, like, I really want to do something with this when I grow up, though. Because, like, you know, there's people in our class that, you know, are doing bad, are into drugs, into a lot of stuff. And it was great for them to come in there to, you know, make them do something positive, not just go, you know, just to experience this so they could do something positive in life. And so for me, it was really great. And I think I'm going to use these skills, you know, to just... My talent, I actually learned a lot of things about me in the workshop. I learned that I was active. I could be more talented than I am. And I was really shy, but as I got used to it, and Crystal, my helper here, showed me not to be shy. And, like, I thought I would look good. Like,
do you feel like your talent or your future is in front of the camera as an actor or as a director or as an actor-director?
Well, to me, it's like, right now, I'm into this thing, but I want to be a lawyer or something. But at the same time, I could work on being on the camera and being a lawyer at the same time. You never know. Or, you know, helping my family go into this business and stuff. And I could, you know, show them some little skills that I learned here.
Well, so. I definitely think there's more than enough room for you. And we all got to be Renaissance mm-hmm. women when we have to be. So, Diane, before we've got to wrap this segment, but can you leave people with contact information so if they want to get in touch with you about the event or also support Live Arts, where can they get a hold of you?
Yes, they can get a hold of me at Diane, D-I-A-N-E, at liveartsgroup.org. And the screening, again, is tomorrow night, August 31st, Friday, at Plummer Park, which is on Santa Monica Boulevard, and Martel at 7:30 at night.
Okay, that was the voice of Diane Carey, founder of the Live Arts Group, who was basically one of the coordinators and basically created this amazing 8-week music video workshop for the young people of GLASS, one of the first ever national residential treatment programs designated for self-identified gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth. We've also been speaking with Kenya and Luke from GLASS, two of the filmmakers who will be featured at the free, you heard it, free LGBTQ youth music video screening, which is the results of this training that's going to be held this Friday, August 31st, 7:30 p.m. at Plummer Park. For more information, please call Diane Carey at 323-854-3480. So that was Uprising. Before we leave, I would like to leave you with Uprising's subversive thought for the day. For our quote, I would like to quote poet Audre Lorde, where she said, "Our visions begin with our desires." That was Audre Lorde, noted poet. You have been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our producer, Kelly Barnes is our assistant producer, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website. Uprising's website can be found via kpfk.org. Just click on programs at the left column, scroll all the way down until you find Uprising's website. CDs of the show are available at www.pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Thaymore Soundararajan, sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks for listening. I'm gonna sit for a fountain.